The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. The relentlessness of Manchester City in the Manchester derby. They swat aside United with relative ease, much to the disappointment of the red half of Liverpool. So United stutter in the race for the Champions League spots, but so do Arsenal and Chelsea, while Spurs leave it late but beat Brighton. We'll round up the Football League as Leeds' automatic hopes take a hit. In Europe, there's a stunning volley at the bottom of La Liga. And of course, there's Eric Cantona, an egg and a novel way to crack it. All that plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Here's a question from Spotkick. After two live shows and a previous pod on Monday, who gets the praise for such quality squad rotation today? I guess we have to give that to producer Jonathan Filippo Clare. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you very much.
It's lovely to see you. Michael Butler, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thanks. Yeah.
Excellent news. Barry, in the red zone, but still selected.
I'm fine. I want to play every single game. That's such is my dedication to the cause.
Are you happy when you're rotated out, or do you knock on the manager's door?
No, I don't. I just do what I'm told, but I would imagine quite a lot of people get sick of listening to me, so it's probably no harm that I get rested every now and again.
If you are sick of listening to Barry, below the line
is... you make it sound like people don't do that already.
All right, then. Manchester United 0, Manchester City 2. Huge step towards winning the title for Manchester City. They're on 89 points. A point ahead of Liverpool, both played 35, three games left. I thought Manchester United began this game quite well, but from about half an hour in, City started turning the screw and it felt kind of inevitable.
Yes, it had the feeling of an inevitability about it. So this machine, for once, because usually they do tend to start their games on the up and to score very early on. And you thought, well, it might be that the recipe of enthusiasm plus no Jose Mourinho might do something on the night. But slowly you could see the machine clicking through the gears. And in the end, it was very, very comfortable, I must say. Probably more comfortable than I expected.
Even when they're not playing brilliantly, it's fascinating just how relentless they are. You know, it's wave after wave after wave, isn't it?
Yeah, I thought half-time was a big turning point. I thought that, you know, as we mentioned, I think Manchester City were quite good in the first half, but Manchester City really came out with a real new impetus in the second half. And even after, you thought maybe when Fernandinho went off, that might be a turning point in favour of United, but actually the game turned completely. Manchester City adapted their shape and were even more potent going forward. And from there on in, Manchester United really didn't have a sniff.
Hmm. I wonder if it actually helped City, Fernandinho going off. I mean, I don't know. I suspect I was in a pub with lots of Liverpool fans and they were just saying, we just don't want any change. Don't change anything. And something changed and then City went on. Or does it not matter, Barry? I mean, whoever was playing for City, whoever came on, eventually they would just beat Manchester United because they're better than them.
Well, yes, I think that is the case. They're probably better with Fernandinho than without him. I think stats show that, but such is their strength and depth. You know, you can lose Kevin De Bruyne, doesn't really matter. There are any number of players that are dispensable. Fernandinho is probably the least dispensable of their crew, but you know, as people say, cemeteries are full of people who are considered indispensable, and life goes on. You know, you say it was a massive step towards winning the title. I thought it was pretty routine. I think Spurs, that was a massive step because that was a much more difficult game for City. Manchester United made it very easy for them.
Was it not even a step? It was, you know,
no, it was a step,
just
and another step.
Yeah,
but not as crucial as, you know, people were hoping Manchester United would raise their game from their abject performance against Everton, and I suppose they did a bit, but the bar was so low, they couldn't conceivably have done any worse. And even by raising their game, they're just not as good as Manchester City, nowhere near them at the moment. And so unless City had a really bad day at the office, I don't think it was ever going to be much of a contest.
Two things. First of all, Fernandinho probably been the best Manchester City player when he went off. That's the first
thing. Okay, fair.
And the second thing is that those steps, it's a bit like the paradox of Zeno, you know, that to go cover a distance, you first got to cover half of it, then half of half, then half of half of half, and so on. And you never quite get there. So it is a step, but I still think, I don't know why, it's probably counterintuitive. I always thought that the fate of the title would be decided in the game when nobody really expected it. And it could be a Burnley, for example. I mean, Burnley, who nobody was expecting to do anything much against Chelsea, came back with a draw, looked very stubborn, quite enjoy spoiling a party as well. So I don't think it's... I see, you know, titles like one hand on the trophy, and I think it's perhaps one finger pointing at it at the moment rather than the hand on it.
The goals, Bernardo Silva and Sane, a lot's been made of David De Gea, Michael, and whether he was at fault for both. I think Jamie Jackson gave him 2 out of 10, which seemed a little bit harsh. I don't even think he's blamed, should be blamed at all for that first goal, because Bernardo Silva takes it so early.
Yeah, and it does the classic thing of going through the defender's legs or skirting right next to it. And it, there's always that thing about a goalkeeper being beaten at his near post. But I don't think that the blame can be laid as much as with the second goal. So often this season we've seen De Gea use his feet to such great effect, and he's gone with it again and it hasn't worked out for him. I don't think there's all sorts of stories this morning about Manchester United looking at Oblak as a replacement. I mean, that's... as long as they can keep David De Gea, they should, and I imagine they will keep him. He's still one of the best goalkeepers in the world. He had a bit of a mare last night, but
he made two good saves in the first half from Bernardo Silva and Raheem Sterling. But
saves he probably should have made. I mean, you expect him to make, wouldn't you?
Well, they were decent saves. He should obviously have kept the second one out, and my first impression, I must say, when Bernardo Silva's shot went in, was that he should have done better. But we need a goalkeeper keeping expert.
If he's positioned differently on his line, because he leaves a bit too much space between himself and his near post, he would offer to Bernardo Silva a wonderful area of the goal to aim at, you know. And I don't think it really, the first goal, no, I don't think I would blame it for that. And the second one is pretty much a law of averages, isn't it? I mean, he saved so many goals with this kind of handball or ice hockey kind of saves that you can't really... and to think that, to put the responsibility of what happened on him and solely on him would be absurd, really.
Hmm. Joe Hart was on Sky last night defending De Gea a lot, basically, and said exactly that. He was taken by surprise for the first one. Mm. I mean, I just think, I agree with you, Michael, this whole idea that if a goalkeeper gets beaten at his near post, it's automatically his fault. And sometimes, you know, look at that Higuain shot against Burnley, right? It's absolutely melted the thing. Like, sometimes it's a good shot, right?
Yeah, on the number of goals that Aguero scores at the near post, because, you know, arrowing it in the roof of the net, what can you do about that?
The biggest difference between, say, Edison and De Gea last night was the distribution, and so often Edison got himself out of trouble with those, we might call them risky passes, but actually they find the man, he plays one touch out to the fullback, Manchester City are able to play. Whereas I think one of the biggest problems is that De Gea often gets a sort of dodgy back pass from Smalling, because Smalling isn't able to look forward and panics. And that's not really, I mean, I'm not really trying to attack Smalling for that. He's not, he's a good defender when it's backs against the wall job, when it's PSG. He's a sort of similar to Ben Mee or Shane Duffy in that regard. Like, you know, they all played well when they're under siege. But when it's, you're asking, you know, Pogba is having to drop deeper and deeper and take silly risks deeper and deeper because he's going to have to get the ball off the centre-backs. There's no gallivanting into the midfield, committing further City midfielder. It's always a panicked back pass towards the keeper.
De Gea has made more mistakes this season than probably since his first season, but that's the only season he's had at United where he's had to make more saves per game. I mean, you're more likely to make more mistakes if more people are shooting at you, right? Manchester United have now conceded 50 this season, the most for a United team since the 78-79 season, where they conceded 63 in 42. How was that, Philippe?
That was good. I've read somewhere, by the way, it was the first time they conceded 7 defeats in 9 games since 1962. Which is half true, because in fact, in the season they were relegated in 73-74, they conceded 7 defeats and 1 draw in 9 games in that particular season on the trot. But doesn't look good, I must say. Not entirely unexpected, But I'm a bit like you, Michael, and like you, actually. I thought they were actually quite decent for a while. It just showed their current limits and the fact that this squad is made of round pegs, square pegs, rectangular pegs, whatever you want to call them, and which fit into shapes which have got absolutely no relationship to them.
I mean, I agree, and I thought there was a reaction, and I thought after the game, I saw a lot of people, and I heard a lot of people saying, "Oh, it was a total embarrassment." Imagine, it was totally embarrassing. I felt that was an overstatement, Barry.
I don't think it was. It was a Manchester derby. They were at home. They got thrashed. They had one shot on goal. And if your idea of a good performance is doing all right for half of one half, I can't agree with you.
But you're playing against
Manchester United.
Yeah, but you're playing against the team who are better than you. You know,
Everton was embarrassing.
Everton was embarrassing. But playing City and losing is not embarrassing. You know, they matched them for a half. They had that Lingard chance. You know, yes, City were miles better, but their players are better. They've just been better run for years. I mean,
Their players are better, but their players work harder. A lot of Manchester United players last night weren't really trying a leg.
Do you think? I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, look at the second goal. Sterling takes the ball past Fred, advances towards the penalty area. Fred's jogging along behind him, making no effort.
Fred's been chasing Man City players for the best part of an hour. That's going to tire you out.
Compare that to if you look at Jake Humphrey's Twitter feed, he put a clip up the other day of Ben Godfrey, the Norwich defender, chasing back. In their game against Stoke, he starts at the edge of his own six-yard box and gallops the length of the field to the edge of the other six-yard box to dispossess Benny Kofobe. Now, that's effort. That's a player working hard. Fred didn't do that last night.
And you don't... There's no...
Paul Pogba dawdling around. You know, he's an absolute joke at the moment. I remember, actually, when Mourinho and Pogba fell out, when Mourinho was still there. And, you know, they had that training ground thing that seemed to have been staged by Mourinho for the cameras. And Jamie Carragher said in the wake of that, you know, he said, there's an idea that if Mourinho goes, you'll see a new Pogba. You won't, I can assure you of that. He's not as good as he thinks he is. His big problem is understanding the game. There's other clubs in the world that have been very successful without having Paul Pogba. And people agreed with him at the time. And then Mourinho went and Pogba showed willing for a few games, and people were mocking Jamie Carragher and throwing this back in his face. He was right.
Roy Keane was absolutely magnificent last night.
Do you know what? I was in a pub and they turned the music terrifying. On. I couldn't hear what he was saying, yet he was still absolutely mesmerising.
He was box office, yeah.
What was he saying?
Well, I think there was a quote. I think this is pre-match. Paul Pogba was being interviewed, and he says, "If you want to be the best, you have to beat the best." And he says it sort of half-heartedly and avoids eye contact with the camera. And the first thing is that Roy Keane says is, "I don't believe a word of that." And I love Roy Keane because he's not part of the Sky Sports furniture. He makes guest appearances, so he doesn't do these kind of interviews with Ollie in the tunnel. He obviously doesn't care about keeping relationships, which is brilliant because he speaks his mind, and I think his words are very similar to a lot of the Manchester United fans right now.
He looked as if he was going to clog Gary Neville at one point.
What were they rowing about? Because I obviously couldn't hear it.
Well, I think Neville was trying to half defend or to put the case for the defence, as it were, for Manchester United, saying precisely it was not a good performance, but it was a better performance. There was some reaction, at least, after the disaster of Goodison Park. And obviously this didn't quite convince Roy Keane. I mean, his eyes. I don't think, you know, you said the sound was turned off. Actually, he didn't even need to speak. Just the way he rolled his eyes and the way he clenched his jaws, the way he crossed his hands on his lap, that said everything there was to say about the game and what he thought of this current crop of players.
Some stats on City from Sky Sports Stato. Three players have now double digits in both goals and assists in the Premier League this season. Two of them are City players, Sterling and Sane. Eden Hazard, the other one. Manchester City from Opta Joe have scored 157 goals in all competitions this season, the most by any English side in top flight history, overtaking their own record from 2013-2014. And Colin Miller writing, in the last 16 games, City have won 45 points, more than 10 of their 19 Premier League rivals over the entire season to date.
They've got Sergio Aguero on 30 goals, I think. Two more on more than 20. And I think another three on more than 10 goals. I mean, that's a lot of goals going, being spread around.
Before the game, Solskjaer took the United team to the Cliff, the old training ground, for inspiration. He also said before the game about City committing fouls. Jules, right, City commit 8.5 fouls a game with an average of, 64% possession. That means one every 2.5 minutes without the ball. Cardiff commit 10 fouls a game, one for every 3.5 minutes without the ball. Logically, City are the biggest shithouses in the Premier League, essentially.
That what they are, and I think that maybe that's what Solskjaer was trying to say, even though the stats didn't bear the substance of what he was saying, is that they're intelligent foulers. They're people who foul in the right part of the park. They're people who don't concede free kicks in dangerous areas, which is quite normal because most of the time they're in the other half with 75% possession, and therefore the game is happening elsewhere in an area where you get fewer yellow cards as well. But what they have, which was also something which was a characteristic of Guardiola's Barcelona, is that they have a great knack of breaking down counterattacks by committing very, very clever, intelligent fouls which don't earn you a yellow card, but still break the dynamics of the opposing team. And I think that's what Solskjaer sort of meant, and I think he was correct.
So if they keep doing that, shouldn't they eventually get booked for that?
There was an excellent example of that in the second half where Raheem Sterling got fouled and the referee didn't give it. And then Raheem Sterling quickly got up, sprinted 10 yards, and I think took down, I think it was maybe Martial, just as he was sprinting forward. And it was all about quelling that attack in transition. And I think remembering the City documentary that came out a few months ago, in the dressing room, Pep Guardiola is saying, foul him, in transition, foul. So the frequency of those fouls, as you've mentioned, it might not be as much as Cardiff or Burnley or whoever else, but it's the, as Philippe says, it's the intelligence of those fouls.
But it's cheating. It's not right.
It's not really cheating. No.
I mean, I do it.
Yeah.
Kieran says, Barry, would you let Eric Cantona make you an omelette?
I haven't seen this
clip.
I've heard about it, but I haven't seen it because I was going to have a look this morning, and people went, "No, you really shouldn't."
Problem.
Not in because I've got like a different department behind me. The people who create the Guardian Weekly magazine, and
it's unlikely to get in Feast magazine, I'll be honest. I would recommend not watching it in a busy cafe. Producer Jonathan writes, be careful. So if you haven't seen it, I wouldn't, but it is a man using his erect penis to crack an egg, let's face it.
It's not Eric, is it?
It's not Eric's.
And what is the...
Eric has us holding an iPad, basically, and the camera pans down, and the man is...
what is the significance of this?
Well, that is a very good question. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
It wasn't related to this game, or no one knows.
It's another seagull.
Exactly. We're in sardines and trawlers territory here.
Anyway, thanks, Eric. Man United have conceded 13 since they last scored an open play. That's from Richard Jolly. Look, they play Chelsea at Old Trafford this Sunday. Massive for their Champions League aspirations and Chelsea's. They're still in the hunt, which is unbelievable.
Yeah, because everybody's going Spursy.
Exactly.
Apart from Spurs.
AT says, would Man United be any worse off today if David Moyes was still managing them?
They would have reached the same stage in the Champions League final. The quarterfinals. In terms of points, they might be slightly better off.
How do you know these things?
I think
Because that's our job.
I think as it stands, if Moyes' contract was to be honoured, he'd still have 2 months to run on it.
All right.
I'm not sure what that means.
It's not a parallel history. But if we're going to go back in time to see something, it wouldn't be to put David Moyes back in at United, would it? So City go to Burnley. Also on Sunday, I was in a pub with Liverpool fans, as I said, and it was interesting as the game went on how much better Burnley became to the Liverpool fans. They were like, oh, but Burnley, really, you know, they are excellent, aren't they? We'll get on to their game in a minute, their game with Chelsea. But before that, the PFA Team of the Year, 6 City players in the Team of the Year, 4 Liverpool players, and Paul Pogba, which does seem a surprise. Edison with a back four of Alexander-Arnold, Van Dijk, Laporte and Robertson. Fernandinho, Pogba, Bernardo Silva, Mane, Aguero, Sterling. Pogba's the only one there that you could argue with, right?
Yeah, and I think it has to do with the timing of the vote. I think most players would have cast their votes when there was this this you know succession of games, which Manchester United won almost at every occasion, and Pogba scored something like 9 goals during that period, and I think they were impressed by that, and they thought, well, we're seeing the real Pogba, and then the real Pogba turned up, or rather didn't. And I think that explains, this is the only reason I can find for that, because that's totally absurd. You can think of, I don't know, probably a dozen midfielders who would deserve a place ahead of Paul Pogba in that PFA 11.
Wolves 3, Arsenal 1 then, last night. Wonderful free kick from Ruben Neves. Matt Doherty, Diego Jota with the other goals. They move up to 7th.
Can I controversially say that I think Matt Doherty should have been in that team of the year?
Over Alexander-Arnold?
Yeah.
You can say it, yeah. Mm. He's had an excellent season, hasn't he?
Yeah. I wasn't expecting him to be, but I think he... I sort of did in just a few players I think could feel slightly hard done by, you know, wild cards that I'd have on my PFA bench. And Doherty, Ruben Neves, Holly Bass from Watford, and perhaps Connor Cody as well, centre-back.
Eden Hazard.
Yeah. Oh, and Eden Hazard, yes, of course.
Yeah, so he's on the shortlist for the Players Player of the Year, the 6-man shortlist of the league's best player, but he can't make the 11-man shortlist for the Team of the Year. I don't understand that with Hazard.
Well, I guess it depends on the formation you're picking,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but you can change the formation and shoehorn him in.
Oh, you can do a Garth Crooks.
Yes, exactly. In this case, I'm willing to do that.
Can I put on the bench for the PFA? Can I put Moussa Sissoko?
Yeah,
on the bench.
Absolutely. There are no Spurs players in that at all, and you'd maybe mention that.
Oh, it's like picking Paul Pogba ahead of, I don't know, Christian Eriksen. Mm. It's like, what? Mm.
The only other one that you might argue is Alisson ahead of Edison. He's conceded 2 fewer goals and he's made 2 more clean sheets. I think, as you know, there are a variety of factors why it might have been form at the time, or Edison is, I mean, I think Alisson is the Brazil goalkeeper.
Mm. Yes.
So in people that know what they're talking about with football, he is the better goalkeeper.
Oh, it's fine margins, isn't it? Okay, back to that game. Wolves 3, Arsenal 1. Wolves up to 7th. A couple of questions on Wolves. Given their resources, Barry, and you've sort of been down on finishing 7th and winning the Everton Cup and getting to the Europa League, but given how much money they've got, could it actually be good for them and they could give it a go in a way that, say, Burnley couldn't?
Yeah, definitely. And I think a team like Wolves, with their history and their proud tradition, I think their fans would really relish a return to Europe in a way that fans of other clubs might not be that fussed, because it's so long since they've been there. And as you say, they do have the resources to battle on several fronts. I firmly believe if they can hang on to Nuno that they'll be knocking on the door of the top four sooner rather than later. I've said that since the start of this season.
Well, that was my second question. Given their resources and given how much rebuilding work you think United, possibly Chelsea and Arsenal need, could you, Philippe, see Wolves challenging for that top six?
What I would say is that I think we went from a top 2 to a top 3 to a top 4 to a top 6, and we could be up to a top 8 next season. Because you would say exactly the same thing about Everton. I think if they've finally found some kind of balance and if they can carry on this kind of dynamic, they would also be there. What I mean by top 8 is those teams which can finish with, say, between 55 and 65 points, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. And enough to challenge for a spot there and to have as well the points shared more evenly than is the case at the moment, where you've got, which is actually quite extraordinary, such a huge difference between this top 6 and the rest of the league. But yeah, absolutely, there's no reason if they hold on to Nuno Espirito Santo.
But the thing is, Wolves have the comparatively easy task of having to figure out how to do better against teams, say, in the bottom half of the table. They're grand. You know, I think they've beaten 4 of the top 6. And it's lesser teams, inferior teams that cause them problems. And that, you would think, shouldn't be, as problems go, it's a nice one to have. How do we figure out how to beat, you know, Huddersfield?
I mean, I wonder if you could potentially add Leicester into that, depending on what they do.
Because they've got exciting
young players.
Why not? And they've got actually a very, very good squad. And as you say, a squad of very young players. And it's funny, this year, the teams that could perhaps aspire to a spot in the Europa League, I think of all those, the only one which would probably suffer would be Watford. Yeah. The others, I think, would all welcome that. I think Leicester would welcome that. I think Everton would welcome that. Wolves would welcome that as well.
Presumably Watford. Oh, not Watford, not in it because
no,
they're in the cup final.
The losing finalists no longer qualify for the Europa League. It's only the winners.
Good to learn things. But Leno didn't have a great game, did he? I mean, two of the goals were his fault, but he's generally had a good season.
He's had a good season, and lately he's had a very good season, and he's shown in recent games why he had been taken on and was preferred to Petr Cech, even Petr Cech on the way out, who remains a very fine goalkeeper. And he, over the last few games, he's actually saved a lot of goals and a lot of points for Arsenal. So I think it would be a bit, I mean, that wouldn't be right to say that it was his fault. It seems more that at the moment Arsenal are caught in this strange dilemma, which is which competition do we go for, and that almost unconsciously you wonder if Unai Emery, who's got such great experience in winning the Europa League, is not thinking, actually it's going to be easier. And that... He's not going to say, oh, we don't care if we lose or something like that. No, but unconsciously, it could play on the players' minds. Mm.
3 defeats in 4 in the league for Arsenal.
Yeah,
and they've won
good.
Fewer points away from home than any of the rest of the top six, Crystal Palace, Leicester and Watford.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the disparity, I know they lost at home
shocking.
To Palace, but the disparity from home to away is ridiculous. Right?
Yeah. They've had problems at home too, but which very often glossed over by good second half performances at the beginning of the season. I remember a game against West Ham where they should have been 3-0 down, I think, after 45 minutes. And they've been able, because it's the Emirates, because of the support of the public and so forth, to do something about it. Away from home, they've looked a completely different proposition. But not always. They were great at Napoli, for example. How do you explain that? And then again, I come back to the idea that perhaps the Europa League is now number one objective.
If Arsenal play Chelsea in the Europa League final and finish fourth and fifth in the league, it's possible one team might deny the other Champions League spot twice in the same season. Arsenal's win percentage with Ramsey starting, 71%. Ooh. Without, 48%. I mean, they really need to hang on to him.
They can't. Sorry, I really fell for it. You know, I fall for everything. I once a friend once told me, you know, they've taken the word gullible out of the dictionary, and I said, really? That's how bad I am. I trust you, Max.
Yeah, I know those stats, by the way, from Orbino, who's an Opta man and Arsenal fan as well. But he's a massive loss, right?
Yep.
And it's interesting how much we talk about the Manchester United rebuilding job. How much building? Is it rebuilding or is it just more building?
There are a number of very good players there. There is the structure is absolutely fine. I don't know about the recruitment policy or it's going to pan out now that Sven Mislintat is no longer going to be with the club. There are areas which demand close attention. And perhaps as well, you should keep in mind the fact that they haven't been very lucky with impact injuries this season.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you lose, you finally had a stable back three with Rob Holding, who was really impressing a lot. Then he gets injured for the rest of the season. Hector Bellerin is coming back in good shape. He gets injured for the rest of the season. And it carried on like that. And every single one of them was injured at one point or another. So it's a question of perhaps getting rid of some players, including some that they wouldn't want to part with. That's obviously Aaron Ramsey. Addressing some problems in defence. Clearly, I mean, you know, if you say the words Shkodran Mustafi in a pub of Arsenal fans, you're going to hear some comments here. I can tell you that.
Arsenal's next away defeat will be at Leicester this weekend. and on Saturday, Wolves go to Watford in a massive game in the race for the Everton Cup. Watford just a single place and a point behind them, and that'll do for part one. And part two will begin with Chelsea's draw at home to Burnley. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the 10th of May at Earth in Hackney, me, Barry, Wilson and Lars doing a live show. Come along and we'll chat, won't we, Baz?
Yeah, I'm hoping we'll, once again, as we were in Glasgow, be sort of in the dressing room / green room next door to a Canadian rock band.
Thrash metal, let's be
an
clear.
An impoverished Canadian thrash metal band. Who gleefully devoured what crumbs we threw them from our table in the form of pizza and crisps and grapes and chocolate. Because I think, you know, they're going around Europe in a little transit van, probably living on £5 a day each. And I've never seen such pathetic gratitude. So I wish them well. I can't remember what they were called, though, so I can't give them a plug.
I know that the main act were Monster Trucks.
Yeah, who are playing in Camden this Saturday. Oh. We should go along for a reunion.
Yes, go along for the support act, who, to be fair, were terribly noisy. And we did ask them to turn the bass down at half time. Yeah. It was like dodgy neighbours. Really?
And we scratched an 11 in our amp to turn it up a bit more.
They're called Royal Tusk.
Royal Tusk.
They're from Edmonton, I think. Yeah. And they were very nice. And they had a football. So
Edmonton, played very, very well behaved young men for metalers.
They have come a long
Edmonton.
Way.
Edmonton. Yeah. Yeah, there's the oil city of Alberta.
Yeah, well, they were delightfully nice. And their lead singer has downloaded the pod. So we should probably stream some of their work.
Yeah.
I mean, I prefer an acoustic set, if I'm honest, but I'm quite old, just in case lead singer man, you're listening. Chelsea 2, Burnley 2 then. Because Arsenal and United keep losing, Chelsea actually moved up to fourth position with this draw. How come none of these teams are winning? Why are they all stuttering? So can we put a finger on it?
It really looked as... when Chelsea did eventually take a very quick 2-1 lead, that was going to be that. And they were 2-1 up at home. They were seemingly in control. And I think their lead lasted maybe five minutes. And for the rest of the game, they didn't really fashion a good chance. I think Aspilicueta had a volley but there seems to be no sort of real creativity outside of Hazard, and when Kante went off and when Hudson-Odoi went off, they lacked real energy, and they just kind of resorted to pumping balls into the box, which was kind of food and drink for the Burnley centre backs.
And ironic that that's what they were doing after when David Luiz at the end says it's anti-football, talking about Burnley losing time all the time, he says, especially when you have the ball. Their players went to the floor and stopped the game. It's difficult when you play against a team who have two chances and score two goals.
It's David Luiz talking about shithousery. Amazing.
I mean, Tom Heaton did get booked for time wasting after the 31st minute.
Marvellous. That's tremendous, isn't it?
There was a fair amount of shithousery going on, but I mean, Burnley definitely had the better chance. I think Chris Wood went through on goal in the second half, and if he had a slightly better touch and a more confidence in his left
foot. This is honey in Liverpool supporters' ears, what you're saying right now. So yeah, we're bigging up Burnley now.
Yeah, exactly.
And at home, they are much harder to beat, I think. So
Ashley Barnes, who is an excellent shithouse, isn't he? I mean, let's face it, he spent half the time just winding up Mateo Kovacic, bundling him out of play and then laughing at him when he reacted, getting a reaction out of David Luiz. David Luiz, who also said Kevin Friend laughed in his face and told him to shut up.
Fair enough.
But it's interesting, isn't it? When a team, right, obviously Burnley are happy with a draw and Chelsea aren't, and this happened at the end of Man City Spurs as well. Spurs were losing and Sterling was acting up with Vertonghen, and Vertonghen, you know, I mean, I suppose you just can't help it. It's a human reaction. But the Chelsea players, what Burnley want is to get involved in a massive 22-man scuffle and just wind the clock down. Mm-hmm. Surely you've got to think, let's not have a fight. Let's try and get the ball.
Which is, by the way, to come back, but what's threatened to break out in the Manchester derby, and you thought, ooh, maybe that would be a way, actually, for Manchester United to really to do something in that game, is to actually make it descend into this kind of a play, you know, schoolyard scuffle. But again, it's really odd, this Chelsea team, because we thought they were back. We thought they'd found a new dynamic, new impetus, whatever. And then it doesn't seem to be the case. I genuinely don't have an explanation for the Spursiness of the top six at the moment.
Do you have any idea of what Chelsea need to do in the summer? I mean, we all imagine Hazard will go, right? Does anyone think
he will go? What is the biggest question, I think, for Chelsea fans is rather what's going to happen with Roman Abramovich.
And the transfer ban as well.
The registration ban, yes, is a problem. They can still appeal. They have to go to a different instance for that, a different organisation for that. But they can still appeal. So all hope is not lost in that particular area. But the thing is that the rumours about the sale of Chelsea are more than rumours. The club is for sale. It is actually mandated to different entities to approach possible buyers, asking for an awful, awful lot of money, by the way. And this is going to create a lot of insecurity, I would imagine, within the club. And at the moment, you think, well, what can they do? Are they going to get rid of Sarri? Who are they going to take? Explain to me. I mean, who are they going to take who is going to be a major improvement on Mauricio Sarri, who had no preseason, who had a fantastic start to the season, then had a collapse, then rose again, and might still win the Europa League and might still finish in the top four?
Would Allegri be around?
It seems like, contrary to what was thought, he's going to stay for another season. Okay. Yes.
What about Frank Lampard's Frank Lampard?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, now there you go, yeah.
Allardyce?
Mark Hughes is available.
I'd love it to be Big Sam. You know, they were going to do that redevelopment of Stamford Bridge, which was then put on hold. Have they got planning permission for all that?
They have. I don't want to say anything stupid, but I do think they have planning permission, yes, even though there was one sticking point, which is this house at the corner just behind the Matthew Harding stand, which refused to budge, and this resistance by this tiny passport to Pimlico kind of household was preventing them from going about. But obviously, the club is worth far more money if you've got the planning permission.
Did you ever see in China, there was an old woman who refused to move when basically the state wanted to build a massive quarry, and they just built the whole quarry, massive thing, like square miles with just a tiny path and a little house on just a tiny plinth, it looked like.
My godfather used to live on the land where Chelsea's training ground is, and when they bought all the land, I think they bought it from a hospital who had their training pitches there. He just refused to sell, and they came back, and they probably went through five or six iterations before they eventually got up to a price where, and he was like, all right, in the end, and he held out for maybe, I don't know, 6 months, a year.
Oh, great work.
Yeah, it's good work.
The goals were nice in this game, weren't they? Jeff Hendricks' volley was good. Kante, a nice swept home. Higuain's beautiful finish after a lovely back heel from Aspilicueta. And Ashley Barnes with a very Burnley-esque goal, but poor defending, wasn't it? Burnley bench allegedly called Maurizio Sarri a shit Italian at one point, which apparently caused a ruckus in the tunnel.
I didn't realise, but Ian Wohn was at the centre of it. He's one of Dyche's assistants. I didn't realise that. But
lovely left foot he has.
Yeah, lovely.
But I mean, if he said that, not quite as careful choice of words as his cultured... His left foot is more cultured than his mouth, then, allegedly.
more than 20 years ago, I had reason to interview Kelly Wohn, who's Ian Wohn's wife, or she was at the time anyway. She may well still be, I don't know. But she's a very nice, polite, demure American woman. And she contributed to this anthology about footballers' wives, sort of before WAGs, for want of a better word, became a thing. And I asked her how she'd met Ian Wohn, and it turned out I think she'd been in Miami on spring break or something, and her and her friends were laughing at these two really pasty guys who were gadding her out the beach wearing really tight budgie smuggler speedos. One of them was Ian Wohn, who she went on to marry, and the other was Teddy Sheringham.
Of course.
This is from Liam at Official Vizair on the subject of Ashley Barnes. He says, I think he's a Burnley fan, suggested to Liverpool fans this. He said, I woke up greeted by 5,000 Liverpool fans with Ashley Barnes as their profile picture. What a time to be alive. We are all Ashley Barnes, say the Liverpool fans. Tottenham 1, Brighton 0. They left it late, but Philly, what a strike from Christian Eriksen.
Glorious.
The phrase
it?
I have used before is that the ball stayed ball. I can't work out a better way to explain it. That when it's struck, it doesn't deviate, it doesn't move, it doesn't spin, it just stays motionless yet moving.
I can't add to anything as beautiful as what you just said.
Oh, thanks.
I'm choking, really. No, it was a glorious, glorious goal, which is a bit of Pochettino Spurs' specialty, isn't it? Those late goals. That was the case the season before. It's been the case again this time against a Brighton side that surprised me, I must say. I think they were much more impressive than they'd been of late. I'm trying to think of a word to describe what Spurs are doing. It's not, they're not crushing literally the teams, but there is something behind them which seems almost unstoppable. You knew they were going to score, which is not something I would have ever dreamt to say about the Spurs team.
Did Pochettino? He even brought Vincent Janssen on. I mean,
I know.
There was a wonderful moment where Janssen's taking off his kit to come on, and Eric Dier is just in the background, just giggling and pointing, and presumably they have quite a good relationship. Mm. But that sort of the absurdity of the situation of Spurs need a goal, here comes Vince.
Ah, it's good for him to get on the pitch, wasn't it? His name wasn't even among the squad list on the back of the club's own programme. There's no number nine between Harry Winks and Harry Kane. Eriksen, since his Premier League debut in 2013, he's scored 21 goals from outside the box in the Premier League, more than any other player. He's a delightful footballer, isn't he? Because he's not so quick. And he's not.
Oh, he doesn't look like a footballer. No. He doesn't have the physique of a footballer. You don't think so. He's one of the most intelligent players there are out there. And it also is striking that he had a mixed season, I would say, up until a few weeks ago. And it's just when Spurs really needed him to come back with Kane's injury and so forth, that as is happening with this team, every time somebody's misfiring, somebody else takes over.
Spurs had 29 shots, most they've had this season, the most Brighton have conceded in a Premier League game. I mean, you've got a feel for Brighton, Barry, haven't you? I mean, some Duffy and Dunk, it was sort of like platoon, the way they were defending, you know. So every time, you know, it seemed like, I mean, Matt Ryan had a good game as well.
I was going to say, Matt Ryan had
quite a lot of the time they were behind him, hoying it off the line. And then when Eriksen scored, they all just sunk to their knees.
Yeah, I have a certain amount of sympathy for them, but this should be a game where it should have been, if Brighton hadn't performed so awfully against vastly inferior opposition to Tottenham, this should have been a kind of free swing for them. You know, well, hopefully we'll get something out of it. Whereas because of their own ineptitude in previous games, they kind of really did need something out of it.
A bit of breathing space for Spurs, 3 points clear of Chelsea, three to play, superior goal difference as well. They've won all four of their home games in their
not
new
conceding a goal.
Stadium. Exactly, scored eight, conceding none.
How long has it been since Brighton scored last?
According to producer Jonathan, their last goal was on the 17th of March in the last minute against Millwall in the FA Cup.
And they've played seven since.
Yeah, that's quite a long time.
Bit of a problem.
It's an issue. Now, Spurs play the early kickoff on Saturday against West Ham. A win then puts them 6 points clear of fourth. Also, their game with Bournemouth next weekend has been moved to the early Saturday kickoff from a Monday night to give them more time to prepare for the Champions League semi-final second leg. All of the Eredivisie games have been postponed this weekend so Ajax can prepare. Danny Rose says, I couldn't believe it when I heard that's what the Dutch were doing. It'd be nice if the people in England took a similar stance and helped us out. Ultimately, it's not Tottenham against Ajax. We're England. We want to bring the Champions League, obviously, to Tottenham, but we want to bring it to England. Is Danny right to think that all fans in England want Tottenham to win the Champions League?
No, he's not. What I find amusing about that is both Gary Lineker and Jake Humphrey were getting on their high horse about the fact that the Premier League weren't taking what I found quite funny about that sort of topic is that both Jake Humphrey and Gary Lineker were both getting on their high horse complaining that the Premier League weren't giving a helping hand to teams by rescheduling their games, when in fact it is Jake and Gary's employers who are completely to blame for the fact that they have to play, you know, 10 minutes before a Champions League game.
Could Gary say, actually, although he is employed by BT, he's only doing the Champions League for BT, so it's not his fault because he's not actually hosting the Premier League games. Where, I mean, it's obviously completely Jake's fault and the Sky lot, but Gary could say that's match of the day, just comes on when it comes on. So he might be innocent.
Oh, so you're exclusively pointing the big finger of blame at Jake.
No, I'm giving it to Jake and, I think Dave, it was Gary, and Dave Jones and Kelly Kate.
Gary originally made the point and Jake concurred. So. Mm.
This is classic Gary Lineker media bias.
Yeah, absolutely. All the Dutch games, by the way, cancelled to avoid Ajax and their opponents, De Graafschap, who were due to face each other on Sunday, playing at the end of the season once all the other games have taken place. Watford won, Southampton won. Shane Long scoring the fastest Premier League goal ever. Just 7 seconds closing down Craig Cathcart, blocking his clearance, running onto it and dinking it beautifully over Ben Foster.
If I was Craig Cathcart, I would find it very difficult to resist the urge to punch him in the face for doing that. I really would. I did a similar thing in just a kickabout in school. As soon as it started, closed down whoever the ball was passed to from kickoff and scored. And he chased me around the all-weather pitch for about 10 minutes.
I've had that. Keeper late, runs on the pitch. We try exactly that, you know, boot it long, knocked down. He slipped in the sand. He hadn't done any warm-up. Ball goes, you just think, God, we've done all that warm-up. Well, that's what the Watford players must be thinking. We've done all that. We've done all this. You know, nothing silly. First five, 7 seconds. 3-4 now for Shane Long. Andre Gray equalised in the 90th minute. Well, Duncan Alexander on Opta says, for those asking about gaps between Premier League goals, Marouane Chamakh scored after 37 seconds and 93 minutes and 3 seconds against Wolves in 2010.
Yeah, outside of the Premier League, in 1978 in the European Cup semi-final, FC Bruges scored in the third and then the 116th, if we're ever allowing.
But still, there's another goal there, so I'm, you know... Well, there must have been another goal, mustn't there?
No, there's... You mean,
oh, between, second leg, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Between... Yeah, it was Bastins and... Van der Raken.
Ah, two of my favourite players, yes, as well. Over the last 8 games, Southampton are 7th in the form table, Everton 3rd, Leicester 4th. Are you interested to see what Ralf Hasenhüttl can do after a summer in the transfer market?
I would rather, because especially since he's never been, I mean, his career is not the longest of careers, but he'd never been in charge of a team that was going, that was in a bad dynamic, that was going down in terms of results. He always took care of teams which were on the up. And you would think that now they will have to be on the up and that we will see the real Klopp of the ups or whatever it's called. It was an inspired choice, wasn't it? I mean, you could say not being Mark Hughes helps, but it was still an interesting choice. And it's actually a squad, when you look at it, there are some very decent players in there. And you would expect Southampton perhaps to go back to where they belong, which is probably mid-table.
Southampton host Bournemouth at the weekend. In the Football League, there was a full fixture list on Monday. Norwich drew again, 4 in a row now, this time at Stoke. They need just a point from their last two to get promoted. Below them, another win for Sheffield United, another defeat for Leeds. So the Blades, 3 points, much better goal difference. One win should do it for them. And they're at home to Ipswich next. Generally, seems to be disappointment that Leeds aren't going to make it automatically. Is that just the Bielsa... That's just the Bielsa's more interesting than Chris Wilder.
I'm not sure it's disappointment. I think there's a lot of interest in it. But yeah, you're right. Sheffield United have been magnificent this season, and none more so than on Monday. I think they did get an easy ride at Hull. I think they were up 3-0 up within sort of half an hour or something like that. But yeah, I think. There's just been a lot more media coverage. Bielsa's an interesting man. We had the scandal earlier this season. They're an interesting team. But just very slowly and quietly, Sheffield United have been going about their business. I thought it was really interesting how they, in the PFA Championship Team of the Year has been released, and there's no Sheffield United defender in there, despite the fact that they've, a big part of their success has been the fact that I think they've got the best defensive record in the division. And again, it's like there are two Leeds players at the back. Admittedly, that Janssen and Cooper have played well, but yeah, you could easily have Jack O'Connor or John Egan in there.
Tammy Abraham's in it. Villa have won 10 in a row. Should Chelsea give Abraham a go next year?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. Especially, I mean, the future of Higuain is still undecided, but I can't see him staying. And I think, you know, that would be the choice between Giroud and Abraham. I think with the position that Chelsea are in, I think that's a good option, provided that they can't buy anyone.
And Giroud's future is also not exactly clear.
Yeah. Dean Smith's done amazing job. I mean, 10 wins in a row, that's a record for Aston Villa, beating the one from 1910. And just before that, they'd gone on a run of just one win in 10.
I think Villa must now be absolutely delighted that Thierry Henry said no when they approached him. They must be absolutely delighted when they saw what happened at Monaco and say, well, actually, we did very well out of Henry not going to Villa Park.
That. Yeah. It's very likely they'll play West Brom in one semi-final, and the other one will be Leeds versus one of Derby, Middlesbrough, or Bristol City?
Middlesbrough. Tony Pulis back in the big time.
Is that what you want, Philip?
Well, they were terrible.
I wouldn't mind.
They were absolutely awful at Forest on Monday. I think they lost 3-0.
But it seems they've been awful for about for the whole season, if I can tell. What are they still doing there?
Yeah, there was a point at which I think Barrow were losing, and at the very last minute, I think Derby scored 2 goals in injury time to move up into 6th, and you'd say it was kind of theirs to lose at the moment.
League One, Luton conceded a last-minute equaliser at home to AFC Wimbledon. Huge point at the bottom for AFC Wimbledon. Luton are 3 clear of Barnsley in second, 5 clear of Portsmouth in third. Portsmouth have a game in hand. They've won 7 in a row. Looks like the playoffs for Sunderland then, Barry. In the PFA League One Team of the Year, second place Barnsley had 5 players on the list. Luton only had 2. Including James Collins, the league's top scorer. Portsmouth got 2 as well. Aidan McGeady of Sunderland, Doncaster's John Marquis, the other 2. Is that a good League One Team of the Year? Are we happy with that, Michael?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see McGeady in there because he's obscenely talented and arguably playing at a much lower level than he should be. But so often we see sort of players go down to that, and especially a player like him, they're sort of kicked and balls sort of bypass the midfield. And the fact that he's actually been able to assert himself this year, he's been a very important part of why Sunderland are doing well. It doesn't look like they're going to get there on automatically.
Well, Mert always said when he went to Walsall that he was playing passes that were really good, just no one else was on the same wavelength, so they looked really bad. At the bottom, I remember saying a few weeks ago Plymouth were in trouble, even though they're in mid-table. Since then, they've gone on a woeful run. They're now a point above the relegation zone. Bradford are down, but still, it's 3 from 10, really. I mean, it's madness, isn't it?
I also saw that the Bradford City ladies team are bottom of the league, played 22, lost 22 with a minus 122, and they play Blackburn Rovers ladies in their next match, who are top. Blackburn have played 22-1-21. So I've been looking. Let's all look out for that result.
Well, fair play for still turning up, you know. In League Two, Bury won, Mansfield lost, MK Dons drew, all of which means there's just a single point between second and fourth. 3 going up automatically, of course. As in the Champions League race, no one wants the final playoff place in this division. Just 2 points separating 7th and 11th. 4 of them drew, 1 of them lost. Most important news, Cambridge United are safe after a 0-0 draw at home to Swindon. All hail Colin Calderwood and his Amber Army. And in the League 2 Team of the Year, 4 players from Champions Lincoln, 3 of the back 4 and striker John Akinde, 3 from Bury in second, 2 from Mansfield. Tranmere's James Norwood, top scorer with 27 goals, and Forest Green Rovers' Reese Brown. Philippe, in football writing news, Carrie Brown appointed as the chair of the Football Writers Association, becoming the first female chair of a major football organisation, replacing Paddy Barclay. Is this an important appointment? Are they important, the football writers? Are you important?
They certainly think they are.
Well, no, it is very important. I mean, the membership has gone from 250 to over 400 now. There's also over 100 students who have now joined as student members. And the way that the national committee is, the makeup of the national committee has completely changed over the Paddy's chairmanship, and it's really moving with the times. And it is a very big announcement, and it has been, I think, acknowledged as such. Not just thinking of, you know, this is how important we are, or we're just a social club or whatever. It's not the case at all, and it remains the organisation which actually represents journalists with Premier League clubs in particular and with clubs of the league. And Carrie's appointment, which is universally welcome within the association, is a very, very, very important moment. But it's a very important moment not in itself. It just is a process which is coming to end of stage one, and now we're carrying on. And also, importantly, Kelly Cates, Alison Rudd and Joel Bayer have also joined the National Committee. So we're getting there. We're inventing ourselves.
We should end part 2 with the sad news of Billy McNeil's passing, the Celtic legend dying at the age of 79. Voted Celtic's greatest ever captain in 2002. He won 9 league titles as a player, 13 domestic cup titles, as well as that famous European Cup win in 1967 as part of the Lisbon Lions. He played 822 times for Celtic, as you pointed out, Barry, to me earlier in the week. Started and finished every single one of those games. Won 29 caps for Scotland, scoring three times for his country. Managed Celtic to eight major titles, as well as having stints at Clyde, Aberdeen, Man City and Aston Villa. And by all accounts, I don't know if you met him.
I met him, interviewed him.
Apparently
a
wonderful man.
An absolutely magnificent man. I would say elegant is the word I would use to describe him as a person. Wonderful, extraordinarily helpful, humble, but also with a real aura about him, as you know, befits the captain of one of football's most legendary teams.
And the Lisbon Lions story is extraordinary. It's magnificent. I mean, just every time you read about it, they can't all be from there. You think you can't? That's just not possible, right?
Yeah, it was. I was going to say the guy on the bench. The guys on the bench, but actually no. and the fact that this team also, beyond that, stayed together at the top of the European game until the beginning of the 1970s, which people forget about. That you always think of them as a one-hit wonder. They were not. They were a very successful act for a number of years.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll round up Europe in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. In Spain, Barca took a huge step towards the title in La Liga, winning 2-0 at Alaves. They need just 3 points from their final four games to lift the title, 9 points ahead of Atletico Madrid with a better head-to-head. Atletico went ahead three times in their 3-2 win against Valencia. Morata, Griezmann and Correa with the goals. Bottom side, Huesca beat fellow Minas Ibar 2-0.
You're calling Ibar Minnows. Sid won't like that.
Producer Jonathan, I am just a performing monkey on this. How would you describe Ibar?
A valiant little team.
Okay.
Punching over its weight. Okay, it's a wonderful story.
Sounds like Minnows to me.
Pow! Minnows.
You must check out the second goal if you get a chance. It's the Paul Scholes volley from a corner type. But in a way, is it better than Scholes? It looks beautiful because of the angle. I don't know if anyone agrees with me. And it comes across from the left-hand side if you're behind the goal. Right foot volley outside of the right foot into the top left-hand corner.
And does the net bulge in just the right way? That's very important.
I mean, I have an obsession with goal nets. It is. I mean, the ideal is obviously off the bar and in, right? That's the absolute dream. Then second best is stuck in the stanchion, which obviously doesn't happen very much.
This one was close.
Yeah.
This one was close. And it had a sort of a real swaz on it. It sort of curled, but at like 100 miles an hour into the top corner.
Yeah, absolutely glorious. What you don't need is the goal nets at the Dell, which they were so tight that they couldn't receive a ball ever. It would just sort of bounce out. And that was
like a tennis net.
Exactly, yeah. Their stadium, Ibar's, holds 7,000, writes producer Jonathan. And he writes FFS as well. So, you know, minnows. Take that Philippe.
The size of the stadium has got nothing to do with the greatness of the story.
Doesn't Bournemouth only hold 11?
Yeah.
So would we describe them as minnows?
No.
No.
Thank you.
But even still, the story can be great. You can still be a minnow. Right.
They're minnows.
It's semantics, this, isn't it? Third play fourth tonight as Real Madrid take a short trip across the city to play Getafe. A draw will guarantee Real Champions League football next season. A fun stat from Colin Miller. In the two games between Real Betis and Levante this season, Betis have had 78 and 72% of possession. Levante have won 3-0 and 4-0.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
In less fun news, rumoured that the Spanish FA are in talks to stage the Spanish Super Cup in Saudi Arabia for the next 6 years in a deal worth 30 million euros per season. The morality of the deal is one thing. The timing, Philippe, is...
They're too intertwined because the information was leaked. It's not quite yet an agreement. The information was leaked or became public on the day that 37 people were executed in Saudi Arabia, including a young man who was 16 at the time when he committed the offence that he was tried for. So, it is very much part of this hypocritical relationship that football has with a number of countries. We could cast aspersion. Well, we can point at Spain. I don't think there are many people who are innocent, to be absolutely honest, but this is bad. But it's part also, remember, there are very strong links between Spain and Saudi Arabia. You will remember these players who came to La Liga, young players, I think only one of whom actually played a few minutes. It's basically the reason why this is happening is simply because of money. As you said, it's the 30 million per Super Cup. Yeah, that's a lot. That's not necessarily the loveliest piece of news we had to announce on this podcast.
No.
I just wanted to explain just one more thing,
sure.
Which is really fresh, is that the former chairman of Barcelona, Sandro Rosell, who had been remained in custody for a very long time, has apparently been absolved, had been acquitted, and is now he's a free man. But there's an appeal by the prosecution. And it's a long, long story, which we'll come back to. I'm sure Sid will have a lot to say about that.
All right, we will check in with him on Monday about that. In Italy, Napoli responded to Juventus' title win by losing 2-1 to Atalanta, who move up to fifth, level on points with Milan in the final Champions League spot. Lazio beat Milan 1-0 in the semi-final second leg of the Coppa Italia, the only goal across the two ties. They'll face either Fiorentina or Atalanta, who play tonight, having drawn the first leg 3-3.
Can I just interject and just say that the striker for Atalanta, Zapata, Duvan Zapata, he's a Colombian guy. He's a proper, proper player. And I think he'll definitely be on a lot of Premier League radars this summer.
Thank you, Michael. I will look out for him. And then on another media outlet, I will repeat what you've said and appear much more knowledgeable than I am.
Against Napoli, he scored one and set one up. And all season, he's sort of like this bull of a forward, but in terms of his stature. But actually, you know, there was a kind of a flick goal against Napoli and a really deft assist.
Do you know the Italian for good touch for a big man?
No.
Okay, well, we'll get that off Paolo.
Get that off Paolo.
When he's next in.
They're a really good little team, Atalanta. They've got some players like Alejandro Gomez, who won't be going anywhere. He's sort of a club legend and he's sort of getting on. And he's the driving force. But there's also other players like, do you remember Martin Darun? Who's sort of had a indifferent season in the Premier League, but is one of the players doing really well.
Buon tocco per un grande uomo. Below the line for all the criticism of that. Weird thing about the Coppa Italia, first legs were 2 months ago. It's a long time to wait, isn't it? In Germany, RB Leipzig and Bayern Munich will meet each other in the DFB Pokal final after beating Hamburg and Werder Bremen. Bayern's win a bit controversial. They were 2-0 up. Bremen scored twice in 2 minutes to equalise with 15 minutes left. Bayern were awarded a very soft penalty. Ref gave it. VAR didn't overturn it. I mean, there was contact, but if you ask Lars Lars, that does not mean it's a penalty.
Exactly.
Lewandowski scored that one. In France, a French top flight match will be refereed by a female official for the first time this weekend.
Yep.
Stephanie Frappard will officiate Amiens versus Strasbourg on Sunday. She'll officiate a second Women's World Cup in France this summer. She's been picked by the French Football Federation to prepare her for World Cup conditions. The German referee Bibiana Steinhaus has taken charge of a Bundesliga match, but no woman has refereed top tier in England, Spain or Italy. I imagine it may take a while, but it is a matter of time, it seems, that this will start to happen, we hope.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's a bit slow. It's bound to happen, and it can't happen soon enough, to be honest.
All right, Premier League games this weekend. Friday, Liverpool, Huddersfield. Can you see that being the time when one of the teams drops points, Barry?
I can see Huddersfield dropping points. No, I would imagine Liverpool will thrash them. I'd be astonished if Huddersfield got anything out of that game. But you never know.
Liverpool play 2 days before City for the next two weekends. Does that matter at all? I mean, if they win, they could, you know, does that ratchet the pressure up a bit, or is that just helpful for the media to spend 2 days going, look,
the letter,
yeah,
the letter, really?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Spurs West Ham's the early kickoff. Palace Everton, Fulham Cardiff. That's big for Cardiff, that, isn't it? They could, because Brighton play Newcastle at home, the late kickoff on a Saturday. So Cardiff, if Cardiff win, that does put the pressure on. You know, just before Brighton go out and play.
Definitely.
Brighton have got a horrendous run in with they've got Newcastle at home this weekend, which is somewhat, but then they finish with Arsenal away and City at home. So their game against Newcastle this weekend is like of paramount importance.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? Southampton, Bournemouth, Watford, Wolves, Sundays, Leicester, Arsenal, Burnley, Man City, and Manchester United, Chelsea. in the race for fourth that nobody wants. The Tweeting Seagull writes, Sven to Scotland? Surely not. He's thrown his hat into the ring, which is different to being asked for the job, right? And
he was with the Philippines, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was with the Philippines.
Wasn't the Asian Cup.
The Daily Record claim he's 71-year-old's contacted the SFA to put forward his interest. Other names being considered, Kilmarnock boss Steve Clark, under-21 coach Scott Gemmell, and Derek McInnes, the Aberdeen boss. Lord Keir says, with the dead marching on Winterfell, which manager will be best equipped to set up a defence?
Possibly Dyche, only if he uses kind of homegrown warriors from Winterfell or something okay. like that.
What about, in my mind, Neil Warnock's doing a cracking job at this.
Yeah, he hates invaders.
He does, that's true. Yes, he does. Those dead coming over here, taking our jobs.
Taking over our cemeteries. Yeah. Scandalous.
Dan says, line of duty, who is H? I'm an Arsenal fan and this is much more interesting. I don't know. I mean, look, if you don't want spoilers, then switch off now. But it can't be Hastings. It just can't be. There's no way it can be him.
I've still no idea what you're talking about.
I don't watch it.
I recommend.
Well, he didn't come down the lagging in a bubble. He has made that clear.
It's true.
The only H I know is from Steps.
Okay, it's very unlikely to be H from Steps. But look, we'll only find out in the
fullness of time. It's Jed Mercurio. Anything's possible.
You're right. All right, and that'll do for today. Thank you so much for your time, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Cheers.
Thanks, Philippe.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.